Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
U.S. military officials have filed criminal charges against Military Police Corporal Charles Grainer, a central figure in the Abu Ghraib prison scandal. We'll have more on that in a moment. But first, more than 300 Iraqi detainees were released from Abu Ghraib today, one day after Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz said during Senate hearings that treatment of prisoners at Abu Ghraib was not humane, and a day after Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld made a surprise visit to the now notorious prison. Well, joining us on the line from Baghdad is Vivian Walt. She reports for the Boston Globe and Time magazine. And Vivian, was this a previously scheduled release, or was it a result of marching orders from Mr. Rumsfeld?
It has been in the works for a few days. But nonetheless, I mean, there's clearly a move which has to do with the pressure that Rumsfeld is under in Washington to get perhaps thousands of these prisoners let out of prison very, very shortly. Don't forget, Robin, many of these prisoners have been languishing, really, in cells for nearly a year.
We understand that General Miller, who now runs the prison, has said he wants 300 or 400 detainees per week to be released or transferred to the Iraqi justice system. And is the goal to empty the jail, the prison, entirely?
Yes, I mean, I think eventually, and that eventually could be coming quite soon after the June 30th handover to an Iraqi government, they are going to have to essentially transfer command of the U.S. military detention system in some shape or form. And they realize that the Iraqi security forces are absolutely in no way capable of handling thousands of detainees.
Were you able to see the transfer today?
Unfortunately, what happened was that they actually bussed the prisoners directly out of the prison. Now, many, many of the relatives had heard on the radio or on TV that there was going to be a big prison release, and hundreds of them showed up at the gates of Abu Ghraib prison waiting for loved ones to come out, but couldn't see them because they were bussed directly into the city. So, unfortunately, both journalists and relatives were rather disappointed today.
But eventually there were some reunions. And how significant are these releases to the Iraqi people?
Well, I think it's a good start. I don't think the Iraqis, beyond the relatives, will hail us as any great victory about the detainee issue. They still want to see a lot of changes made. You know, in the Iraqis' minds, the one measure of how seriously Washington is taking this is whether anybody very important has been fired over the prison abuse scandal. And almost everybody to a person that I spoke to yesterday about Rumsfeld's visit said he's still in a job and therefore all of this is window dressing.
Vivian, has news reached Iraq yet of the charges against some of the U.S. soldiers involved in the Abu Ghraib prison scandal?
Yes, they have. And in fact, the coalition spokesman, General Kimmett, just announced about 1 hour ago on television that the most serious charges so far against Grainer have now been issued.
And what is has there been any reaction to that, or is that too new an announcement about Mr. Grainer in particular?
There hasn't yet been a reaction. I mean, partly because this is Friday and it's the weekend here in Baghdad. There certainly will be. I mean, he is the soldier that most Iraqis have seen in the photograph of the naked prisoners, and he certainly is a face that will be very familiar to Iraqis at this point.
Vivian, thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome.
Vivian Walt speaking to us from Baghdad. She reports on Iraq for the Boston Globe and Time magazine.
As we just heard, criminal charges have been filed against Corporal Charles Grainer. Grainer is charged with dereliction of duty, cruelty, and assault and maltreatment of detainees. This comes as new details of the Abu Ghraib abuse emerge today. Statements by Specialist Jeremy Sivitz, the first U.S. soldier facing court-martial, provide grisly detail and new insight into the culture of guards at the prison. For more, we turn to Kate Zernike of the New York Times. Hi, Kate.
Hi.
Jeremy Sivitz, was an MP and a guard at Abu Ghraib. He's now facing court-martial and is pleading guilty. So these new details are coming from statements he's made to investigators?
These are two statements he made in January, just after the investigation at Abu Ghraib began. And he made these statements, I believe it was immediately after the incidents were reported.
And what do we learn from civets that we didn't know before about how these prisoners were treated by guards?
Well, I think actually what the documents do, and in some ways reading the documents for me was a little more alarming than seeing the photos, as much as the photos are alarming, reading how he describes them throwing bodies into a pile and running and jumping into them and making them masturbate and the sort of dispassionate terms. But the other thing I think that this establishes is that, at least in his account, this was not done for military intelligence purposes. This was not done to encourage interrogations. In fact, there were no interrogations going on. This seems to be sort of a slow night at the prison, and they're looking for something fun to do. Up until now, we've heard from defendants that the seven people charged, that they were doing this at the request of military intelligence to try to get detainees to talk. But in this case, it makes it sound like it was just done for fun.
And some of those details are about Charles Grainer, who has now been charged. He emerges as particularly sadistic. Tell us about that.
I'll read you one part. I do not know what provoked Grainer, but at one point after the detainees were stripped naked, he knelt down to one of them that was nude and had a sandbag over his head and punched him in the temple with so much violence and so much force that the detainee actually passed out. And Grainer simply did not call for a medic, according to this account.
Were the upper-level people in the prison aware of any of this happening?
I think at least one person who was a platoon sergeant, Sergeant First Class Snyder, looked down at one point and saw someone stepping on the detainee's toes and yelled that this was enough and to stop. And in Civis's account, he says they were shocked at how loud and how angry he was when he yelled down. But he left the room after about 2 minutes, and they started up again. The other thing Civis says, though, is the investigators ask him directly, if the chain of command were aware of this, if they were in the room, would you have done it? And his reply is, hell no. They knew that we were supposed to do the right thing, which, of course, says that this was not the right thing, and it would not have happened if someone was there who was in command.
We are expecting a guilty plea from civets. The other soldiers, we're told, are going to plead innocent. So what are they and their lawyers saying about civets' allegations?
Well, I think they're saying that civets is saying that it's very convenient for civets to say this. He's saying it because he's looking for leniency. They are sticking by their statements that if anything the other soldiers did was ordered from on high, they would never have punched anyone if they were not being told to, and that things like making detainees masturbate was really just a way to encourage them to talk.
And why were these statements released?
From what I understand, they were declassified and could be released yesterday. I think things are trickling out. The day before yesterday, we had the transcript of a hearing, the preliminary hearing in the court-martial of Megan Ambuhl, who's one of the accused. I think we're just seeing more documents come out. I think in this case, it serves the purpose of at least some of the defendants. For instance, Megan Ambuhl is not mentioned in Civitz's report, and so a lawyer could argue that she should not be charged.
Kate, thank you.
Thank you.
Kate Zernike is a New York Times staff writer. She spoke to us from New York. When a radical Islamic website showed the beheading of American Nick Berg, it also trumpeted who did it, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, head of the al-Qaeda-related group al-Tawhid. The CIA has since confirmed its belief that Zarqawi was indeed Berg's murderer. Joining us on the line from Washington is Melissa Maley. She is a former CIA field agent, now a consultant with CNO Resources. Welcome, Melissa.
Hello.
What's the best guess as to Zarqawi's motives? Was this for revenge for Abu Ghraib, as he claimed, or was that really a pretext?
I think it's a pretext. Zarqawi, he is an individual who's not new on the international terrorism scene, and he is a known jihadi. He fought in the Soviet-Afghan war, and he's very much within the milieu of the al-Qaeda organization. He's not part of it. He runs his own organization, and he just happens to be in Iraq now fighting that because Iraq is the new battlefield for the jihadi movement. When he first emerged on the terrorism scene, it was very much in a Jordanian context. He put together his own group after he came back from Afghanistan. That group was called Junta Shams, and it was the purpose of that was to overthrow the Jordanian monarchy. He was arrested, then he moved out. He set up another group called Al-Tawheed. And that group was made up of contacts that he had made when he was in Afghanistan. He ran a training camp. And these contacts now are all over the world. And it's very interesting to see these links. And this is why the U.S. government is so focused on Zarqawi, because they see him as not being another bin Laden, per se, but being another key organizer like a Khalid Sheikh Mohammed.
Clearly, he wants the notoriety that is going with this horrific beheading of Nick Berg.
Yeah, I think that he's made a decision because his tactics are changing, and by deciding to act in a very public way, what he's doing is, in essence, he's trying to mobilize people, and it's hard to do that when you're on the run and then it's just and you have no access to a broader group. And I think that's what he was using the internet, was using that video as a way to reach out to other people that he think would be sympathetic to the message of restoring Arab honor.
Well, if he's trying to score points in the Arab world, you do have groups like Hamas and Hezbollah who condemn the beheading. There have been other reactions in newspapers throughout the Arab world saying that this was brutish and unnecessary. So is it possible that all of this could actually backfire on him?
I think responsible leaders are standing up and condemning this, but what he is, he's speaking to the street, and he's sending a very powerful message to them that we can empower ourselves to stand up and fight this and preserve Arab honor and Muslim honor.
Well, why do you think Hamas and Hezbollah said what they did?
I think because it will buy them what they think is a little bit more maneuverability, is saying, no, you cannot do this in such a way. But he's moving beyond that. He's trying to hit the raw emotions, and I think he's done it.
Well, and also, doesn't his rise illustrate the short-sightedness of assuming that if we can just get rid of Osama bin Laden, then terrorism's going to go away? Obviously, there's this whole other generation of leaders out there who are going to emerge.
I think this was very much the disaster scenario that was predicted, that with Iraq, decapitating the government structure in Iraq then could prove to be a magnet for extremists, other kinds of extremists there. And this is in drawing in the terrorists to Iraq. And I think that Zarqawi very much represents that, because it is the new battleground.
Thank you, Melissa.
All right. Thank you.
Melissa Maley is a former CIA field agent and now a consultant with CNO Resources.
Just ahead, we speak with Judge Robert Carter. 50 years ago, he helped argue before the Supreme Court that public schools in America should be desegregated. Today, he says the lawsuit didn't go far enough.
And later, the presidential election not getting much airtime with all the news out of Iraq.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
This Monday marks the 50th anniversary of Brown versus the Board of Education, the Supreme Court decision that ended legal segregation in America's public schools. The case was argued on behalf of the NAACP by Thurgood Marshall, later America's first black Supreme Court justice, and by Robert Carter, now 87 years old and himself a long-serving federal judge. Judge Carter recently spoke with Here and Now producer Alan Cockle, who asked if he was surprised in 1954 when the Supreme Court decided in his favor.
I was reasonably sure we were going to get something positive, because the country at that point was engaged in the Cold War, as I recall, and they might not go as far as they went in Brown, but I didn't think the Supreme Court could push us back.
What was the dynamic like within the NAACP legal team?
I was Thurgood Marshall's assistant, and I was the chief architect of the strategy. And Thurgood Marshall was given credit for my work.
Did that bother you?
At the time, it did not. I was developing my own sense of myself as a lawyer. And by the time Brown had come, I felt confident that on civil rights issue, I could match any lawyer in the country.
And did you work well together, you and Marshall?
Oh, yes. Marshall had done very magnificent things, but when I came on in 45, he had reached the point that he was out running around keeping the NAACP people happy, and he did not have the time to do the kind of work that needs to be done, and I was brought on to push the law against discrimination as far as I could. And I think what you people call it now is I was supposed to think outside the box. Is that what you call it? And that's what I did.
So that thinking outside the box and the strategy you crafted had to do with the effects of segregation and arguing the effects.
Yeah, because when we were preparing for the Brown case, I didn't know what were we going to do, how were we going to handle this. It wasn't one of the university cases. This is public schools and so forth. We don't have the issues that you can use, the alumni, public perception. The schools were not select schools. They were all supposed to be the same, public schools. And I luckily came across a study which was made by a professor in psychology or social science at Columbia. And he had traced blacks coming out of the South and out from the segregated schools into Philadelphia schools. And what he found was that the longer they stayed in the Philadelphia school system, unsegregated, the higher they scored on educational tests and IQs. And to me, that meant I had what I needed. And that meant that I interpreted that to mean that segregated education was deleterious to the growth of black children. And that was the thesis on which all those cases were decided.
And was this idea of bringing in a sociological study into the court new?
Well, I'm told it is. I wasn't thinking about whether it was new or old, but I'm told that this was the first time anything like that had been done, and certainly the first time it had been done in the civil rights issues.
The Supreme Court said that this system should be dismantled with all deliberate speed. What happened?
Well, what happened was the Topeka case, which is Linda Brown versus the Topeka Board of Education. Their lawyer was ready to end segregation right away, and he didn't feel that it was any point going on. Everything changed with the old deliberate speed. People who had been ready to desegregate, or at least in Topeka, changed their mind. All deliberate speed meant that, well, you don't have to do it right away. And if you don't have to do it right away, you may not have to do it at all. Topeka, Kansas, is probably today more segregated now than it was when the case first started.
So how do you assess the legacy of the case then, 50 years on?
The direct effect of Brown, that is, Brown was litigated to eliminate school segregation, utterly, abysmally failed. Side effects were tremendous.
Side effects?
Side effects was the creation of an expanded middle class. The government is no longer able to mandate segregation. And although the white section of society believes in and enforces in white supremacy and black subordination, even though it has not been mandated, this sort of stuff has been maintained. The ceiling is still there. It's not as low as it was before Brown. And you can see in places where it's moved now. The woman who was Ofra. Ofra now is probably making more money than most white people. Unheard of. But still, in 54, segregation has ended, and still we haven't moved very far from it. In the central cities, black kids are in these schools that are dilapidated and terrible. Nothing changed.
So what should happen?
What should happen? You know, come on, you know. You know what should happen.
Everyone knows what should happen, but do you have a prescription for how to fix it?
Unfortunately, I don't. I think that the reason that nothing has happened is because we had the wrong target. This is a racist society.
Is it?
Yes, yes. And we were, and Brown, we focused on segregation. What we should have focused on, and of course we couldn't see it then, was the elimination of white supremacy.
How could you have done that?
Well, what we should have been doing was we should have been focused on with propaganda and the case to the Supreme Court and the claim that the society was dedicated to white superiority and black subordination.
But you couldn't have won that case in 1954?
I don't care. Some of us thought we couldn't win the case about segregation in 1954. The issue isn't what you can win. The issue is you have the imagination and stuff, and sometimes... And you push, and sometimes you win. If you don't push, you win nothing.
Judge Robert Carter was one of the lead lawyers for the NAACP in the case of Brown versus the Board of Education. He spoke with Here and Now producer Alan Cockle.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
It's the end of 2 weeks of disturbing news headlines, lurid photographs, and a horrific videotape. And it's just 6 months before a hotly contested presidential election. How have these 2 weeks affected the race? President Bush's approval ratings fell this week to 46%. That's the lowest of his presidency. And some say presumptive Democratic presidential nominee John Kerry isn't taking political advantage of that. But on the other hand, the Bush-Cheney campaign is accusing Kerry of exploiting the current prison scandal for political gain. Well, two political writers join us today. Adam Smith is political editor of the St. Petersburg Times in Florida. Hi, Adam.
How are you?
Good. And Boston Globe political writer Peter Canellos. Welcome, Peter.
Hi.
Adam, let's start with you and with John Kerry. You were with him when he recently visited in Orlando. And here from, you know, our view in Boston, it seems that you open the local papers and on the front page there are pictures of, you know, horrific abuse, heavy news. And inside is John Kerry smiling at maybe a meet and greet, and he seems out of sync.
Well, he seems out of sync with the main news of the day, but there's a feeling from the Kerry campaign that they don't need to pile on to all the problems that are already flooding down on the president.
And how is he being received at these meet and greets? You were with him at one.
Yeah, he's being received well. It's all invited guests is mostly what he did in Florida, and it's hardcore Democrats, so he's obviously received very well. And the local coverage he gets tends to, for the most part, focus on his message of the day or the week, which was healthcare this week.
Peter, your sense of that, what is John Kerry's strategy, and is it working, again, in light of what the big news stories are and what his topics seem to be?
For one thing, he is emphasizing local news coverage. I mean, he's almost deliberately campaigning in smaller cities and towns where his visits are huge news. And he doesn't show up on CNN, but he'll be dominating the local news in whatever town he's visiting. And that seems to be a good strategy right now when there's little that he can add to Bush's problems.
Yet, as you might have seen the headline in yesterday's New York Times, he's said few words about Iraq, but they are too many for the Republican Party, and they've criticized him for that.
Well, that's the trap that he's trying to avoid. I think that if he appears to be exploiting the prisoner scandal for political gain, I think there'll be a bit of a backlash against him or a sense that he's exploiting the troubles of the military as much as the troubles of Bush. So I think he's trying to stay in the background. He did call for Rumsfeld's resignation, but did so only after a number of other Democrats had. You know, he's trying to appear to be enough engaged that people don't make an issue of his disengagement, but he wants to stay as far away from the problems as possible. Mm-hmm.
Traveling with him this week, it was strange because a lot of the reporters were it was like pulling teeth to get Kerry to weigh in on some of these issues that are dominating the news. And yet at the same time, you have the Bush-Cheney campaign attacking him for exploiting what's going on in Iraq.
Peter, how is that going to resonate with some of the core Democrats who may not be seeing him in Florida or in Ohio and want to know where he is?
Well, there's a lot of frustration among the core Democrats, and you've seen some of the alternative press is even calling for Kerry to be replaced as the nominee. So that's not going to happen, and most likely once Kerry gets to the convention and the case against Bush is made more forcefully by the Democrats, the party faithful will be satisfied.
On the other hand, Adam, as you're saying, the Bush-Cheney campaign chairman accused Kerry of exploiting the Iraqi prison controversy for his political gain, as you write. Then I'm also noticing Thomas Friedman, columnist for the New York Times, a supporter of the war in Iraq and a supporter of the Bush administration to that extent, wrote yesterday that he was wrong in assuming that they were doing it for the right reasons. And now he's accusing the Bush administration of waging this war for their own political gain. Which accusation is going to resonate more?
If the Bush-Cheney campaign can convince people that Kerry is exploiting this, that's certainly not helpful to Kerry. But clearly, the polls are indicating that this war is dragging down the president right now.
Yeah. Peter?
The test will come after June 30th with the handover of power. If it appears that Bush is sort of doing in Iraq what he did in Afghanistan, which is turn over various cities to local warlords and kind of hightail out of there, I think that people like Thomas Friedman will rightfully point out that this seems to be a politically motivated move.
Right. We reported yesterday on the backlash, the outrage over the Abu Ghraib prison scandal, people saying that the media is making way too much of the scandal and way too little, for instance, of the horrific beheading of Nick Berg. That backlash that we're hearing, Peter, do you have any sense of how that's going to impact either candidate?
Well, it helps Bush to the extent that it tends to minimize the problems at Abu Ghraib. On the other hand, I think that there's some question as to how durable that backlash is going to be. And once people start investigating these individual prison guards and their commanders, you know, it's possible that the prison abuse scandal will outlast the backlash in a way.
Yeah. Peter Canellas from the Boston Globe, you have covered John Kerry for quite a while. Adam, I'm curious. You saw him in action at a meet and greet there in Orlando, Florida. What's your sense of how he's coming across?
Well, it's interesting. He does a lot of these town meeting formats, and that's probably his best format. He takes question after question, and there's not a single issue that he isn't pretty well versed on. He may not be the most charismatic guy in the world, but there's sort of relentless, at least competence. And you don't find a lot of people that are at all passionate about John Kerry, but it doesn't seem to matter right now. They're passionate about beating Bush.
Boy, Peter, relentless competence. Now, there's a ringing endorsement. I mean, are you getting the same sense that he is more charismatic in person? This seems like it's going to be a campaign of very expensive on-air commercials.
Well, I mean, Kerry is definitely keeping a low profile, and to the extent that he's winning people over in the trenches, that's probably good for him, especially 6 months before the election. I think actually lowering expectations will help for him. It might be that at the convention and at the debates, when people have a chance to really focus in on John Kerry, they'll find that he's a little more charming than they had thought, and in a way he'll benefit from the perception that he's just a dull technocrat.
What do you think each man has to do following these past 2 weeks? We'll start with you, Adam Smith, in Florida.
You have two schools of thought. One is that how is it possible that Kerry isn't trouncing Bush, given all the problems facing Bush? And the other is that here you've got a guy that is still not known to most people, and he's had $60 million of thumping from Bush-Cheney, and he's tied with the wartime president. So it's outside events that are really driving this right now.
Mm-hmm. Peter?
I think that George Bush has to stabilize things in Iraq in a way that is persuasive to people so that by the time of the election, they'll feel as though everything is moving towards a an easy pullout for the United States.
Does he have to make any more of a mea culpa? Last night the president said for the first time, "I was disgraced."
I think that if his numbers drop a little bit further, he might try. he might give in a little bit by showing a little bit more contrition. But you know, he has also shown a great commitment to staying the course and not admitting any mistakes. It sort of has played well for him in that his personal ratings continue to be higher than his approval ratings. Mm. In other words, people's sense of George Bush as a man of character, and I think he's mindful of that as well.
Well, I want to thank you both.
Thank you.
Sure, thanks.
Adam Smith, political editor for the St. Petersburg Times in Florida. Peter Canellos, Washington bureau chief for the Boston Globe.
Still to come, actor Kevin Kline on Being Falstaff.
And we review the new film from Jim Jarmusch.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Dear Attorney Winslow, it is with my deepest regrets that I must submit my resignation as Justice of the Peace for the Commonwealth.
That is Massachusetts Justice of the Peace Linda Gray Kelly of the town of Charlton, reading from a letter addressed to Governor Mitt Romney's chief legal counsel. Her resignation comes as the state prepares to begin marrying same-sex couples on Monday. She spoke with WBUR's Bob Oakes this morning and told him why she is resigning.
Well, as I said in the letter, it is primarily for moral considerations. I'm a Catholic, and I'm feeling that this is not a position that I want to find myself in, because justices of the peace will no longer be given the privilege of turning away couples, as we are now able to do with heterosexual couples, but that chief legal counsel Daniel Winslow told us that we would have to do these ceremonies for same-sex couples no matter what. And the headlines were, "Just do it." And I can't disobey the Commonwealth, and I took an oath to uphold the law, and it now seems that this is the law, doesn't it? Which means that if I'm not comfortable with it, the only fair thing for me to do is to step down. We were also told that there would be a lot of lawsuits, and that because we weren't state employees, we could find ourselves into some serious personal liability. And I am doing this interview because I think that there are justices of the peace out there who don't realize how vulnerable that they are.
I'm wondering, Linda, are you taking this this action, some would call it dramatic action, resigning your post as Justice of the Peace, because you feel it's what you need to do personally, or because it's what the Catholic Church would want you to do?
It's a combination of both, in all fairness. I mean, there are issues in the Catholic Church that I personally don't go 100% along with, and that's okay? But on a personal conscience level, I also feel that this is more than just about religion. I mean, I'm an ordinary person in an extraordinary moment in history, and I understand marriage the same way societies have understood marriage for thousands of years. It's between one man and one woman. And from not a political standpoint, but certainly from a social consciousness standpoint, I feel that I have to make this stand at this time, you know, for what my beliefs are, and hopefully be an example to others who might be sitting on the fence and not sure what to do. So it's sad because I was good at my job, and I enjoyed doing it, and people enjoyed having me do it.
You have friends who are homosexuals?
Yes.
You think they're going to understand this?
They will never understand. And yet, because they are, the key word here is friend. They accept me despite what they might consider my flaws, and I have always been involved in professions that have a large population of gay people, and they are my friends, and they have said to me that they support me in my determination to be who I am, and that's why we're friends in the first place, is mutual respect, and I have no homophobic fear or anything like that. We're all God's children.
Linda Gray Kelly speaking with WBUR's Bob Oakes. Kelly resigned as Justice of the Peace rather than issue same-sex marriage licenses.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Broadway's Tony Award nominations were announced this week, and in an unusual move, the committee included two Shakespearean players for Best Actor in a Play, Christopher Plummer for his portrayal of King Lear, and Kevin Kline in Lincoln Center's production of Henry IV, Parts 1 and 2, as one of the Bard's most beloved characters, Sir John Falstaff.
Give me life, which if I can save, so if not, honor comes unlooked for, and there's an end.
Kevin Kline recalling his character on a visit this week to our studios. He says he relished the chance to play the heavy-set, hard-drinking, whip-smart but decadent friend of Hal, Prince of Wales, because of the complexities and contradictions of the character.
He's a realist. He's a kind of fantasist. He's every man. He is utterly unique. And what's great about him is that he does have this tragic underpinning, but what is essentially a comic spirit. So you're laughing and laughing, and then suddenly he'll say or do something that you think, ooh. So he's really one of those great Shakespearean complete human beings.
Or as some have said, he's everybody's favorite alcoholic. Well, you're laughing with him until you're suddenly shifting a little.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I don't think he was an alcoholic. He's one of those people who drinks, but he's not... at least I didn't play him that way. It has been played that way, stumbling around in sort of a drunken stupor.
Well, you say how you played him. How you played him has been called the performance of your career, a watershed performance, the New York Times said. You're frowning. You didn't think you see him that way?
Well, it sounds like I should give up now. You know what I mean? It's sort of
quit.
Like, oh, the pinnacle, so it's all downhill from there. I hope it's just another step towards him. A future watershed, whatever that is.
Well, I know you had to wear a false stomach to play him because he's usually kind of a roly-poly guy.
Yes.
And what else did you do to, I mean, maybe not in that way, but what did you try to do to bring to this character who's been played by so many?
Well, what one has to do when you're interpreting one of the great roles is realize you are a link in a chain that goes back centuries. And it behooves you to bring as personal approach as you can to make it fresh. In other words, if you have a personal response to it and you put on the fat suit and do whatever is necessary to transform yourself and do it.
Do you have a favorite Falstaff?
Best Falstaff I've seen was when I was in drama school, actually. And the class that was 3 years below mine, put on this exact cutting, this conflation of the two parts of Henry IV.
Do you remember who it was?
Yeah, his name was J.W. Harper. It was one of those occasions where there was a strike or something, so they couldn't wear costumes and there was no scenery. It was all done sort of in rehearsal clothes, and he just sort of had some pillows stuck in his belt. And it was all about acting. It wasn't about spectacle or beautiful production values. I mean, the highest compliment is that I saw it and I said, ooh, I want to do that. I've got to play that someday.
Well, now, perhaps maybe you can thank him when you accept your Tony Award, if
indeed you win. Yeah.
Because here you
and
are.
Blame him if I lose.
Blame him if you lose. Well, here you are up against Christopher Plummer.
I'm not up against him.
How would you put it?
I love Christopher Plummer.
Okay. It's not a competition.
No.
Interesting that there's two Shakespearean actors in the
nice.
Tony nominations.
It says something nice about New York theater this season.
How much weight does this Tony nomination carry for you, someone who's in films and has done so many other things?
I'm very ambivalent about awards in general. I used to be very against them.
Now, why?
Well, I think it's a very subjective thing, one's reaction to a performance. Given a season of actors, I'm always astounded at who wasn't nominated, who was completely overlooked, and I'm frequently astounded by who was selected. What I've come to realize is that it's a TV show, and they're a TV advertisement for Broadway. Anything that's done off-Broadway is overlooked. There's a separate award for that I don't believe is televised. So it doesn't get the kind of advertising that the Broadway season does. But if you just accept it as, we'll see some scenes and some songs and dances and advertise the season and celebrate the season.
And if you win, it's suddenly the best idea in the world.
Yeah, I like to say that I don't believe in awards unless I win them.
Right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Actor Kevin Kline talking about his Tony-nominated portrayal of Falstaff in Lincoln Center's production of Henry IV.
In the days when Sundance was just a tiny film festival in Utah, and before Miramax and Quentin Tarantino redefined the meaning of indies, Jim Jarmusch was the poster boy for independent filmmaking. From his breakthrough 1983 feature, Stranger Than Paradise, to other art house hits like Down by Law and Mystery Train, Jarmusch fused an understated experimental sensibility with avant-garde New York City cool. In his new film, Coffee and Cigarettes, he offers 11 short vignettes, odd, unexpected conversations, really, between celebrities like actor Roberto Benigni and comedian Stephen Wright, or musicians Tom Waits and Iggy Pop. In this scene, Tom Waits jokingly refers to Iggy as Jim.
Look, I'm sorry I'm late, Jim. Boy, oof. Four car pileups. Oof. I delivered a baby this morning about 9 o'clock. I was saving lives. I was out there on the highway. It was, you know, there's nothing worse than roadside surgery. You know, you don't have your own tools, and it's murder. I performed a tracheotomy with a ballpoint pen, and I've been busy. Wait a minute. You're a doctor? Yeah, I'm a doctor. I mean, music and medicine, really. It's really been my thing, is combining the two and living in that place where they overlap.
Tom Waits and Iggy Pop talking over smokes and Java in Jim Jarmusch's new film, Coffee and Cigarettes. Our film reviewer Eric Schaefer says this quirky new movie from Jim Jarmusch is a return to his past, and he's in the studio to tell us why. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Gail.
Well, we know that Tom Waits was in Down by Law, but other than having him back in this film, how else is it a return to his past?
Well, in some ways, it's a return to the past because some of these segments are almost 20 years old. This originally started out as what was supposed to be a film segment for Saturday Night Live, and then every now and then Jarmusch would take the casts from the films he was shooting and would do one of these little coffee and cigarettes conversations, and then apparently in the last year or two, he did several more and put them all together as a feature. And it's also something of a return to his past because it is very experimental. It's very elliptical, and I think it'll remind people a lot of Stranger Than Paradise and Mystery Train, some of his earlier films, as opposed to some of his more narrative films like Dead Man and Ghost Dog.
And this concept of unlikely pairings of famous people, coffee and cigarettes, is the meeting point. Does that work?
Well, it probably wouldn't work at all if it weren't for these quirky pairings. That's what really does sort of help some of these segments take off. For instance, when you find Bill Murray waiting tables in a restaurant talking to two members of the hip-hop group Wu-Tang Clan.
You're GZA, the genius.
That's right.
And you're RZA,
a.k.a.
Bobby Digital.
Yeah, you know it's hip-hop, yo. You know it's hip-hop.
And you're Bill Murray. Bill Groundhog Day ghost busting ass Murray.
Who you gonna call?
I know that. Just don't tell anybody.
Others actually work quite well as little self-contained stories. For instance, there's one in which Alfred Molina, the actor, contacts Steve Coogan, this British actor and comedian, and out of the blue, Molina tells Coogan that they're actually cousins related from way back, and he hopes that they can get to know each other and maybe even make a movie.
We'd be in the movie. I'd be Fred Molina, you'd be Steve Cook, we'd be cousins in the movie. It's fantastic. Oh, it'd be great, absolutely great. You know, or not. Yeah. I mean, you know, we could just hang out.
Yeah, no, we should do that. We should definitely go for a beer sometime.
Yeah, that'd be great. Maybe, you know, go on vacation together, you know, just the two of us sort of, you know, get to know each other.
You're not gay, are you?
And that segment works particularly well because there's a very nice reversal at the end.
What didn't work?
Unfortunately, a lot of them don't work. There are several that are just flat as a pancake that just go absolutely nowhere. So, you know, I think fans of Jim Jarmusch are really going to love it. I think people who are not familiar with his movies and who may not be familiar with a lot of the sort of fringy celebrities in this movie may find it just a little off-putting.
Thanks very much, Eric.
You're welcome, Gail.
Here and now, film reviewer Eric Schaefer talking about Jim Jarmusch's new film, Coffee and Cigarettes.
is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, here and now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.